Today's very exciting because we have a power team of guests, all of them faculty members in the computer science department, here to talk about a range of computer science courses and also the material that you will cover in such courses as those. Think of these as teasers, perhaps, a pre-shopping period. But it's an exciting time, to be honest, to be getting involved in CS itself. The introduction of minors by the college recently has certainly generated interest in pursuing additional courses. And so even if you're not considering becoming a CS major, which most of you will not after this course, but rather are considering minoring it, or at least dabbling some more, know that there's plenty of courses after this one that you are now qualified for, including CS 51, 61, and 171, all of which we'll talk about a little bit today. And know, too, that it's an exciting time, too, because this department, CS in particular, has really grown. I mean, even since I graduated in 99, there are probably twice as many faculty members in the CS department. And in fact, two of the courses you're going to hear a little something about today didn't even exist back then, although I myself will admit to having taken CS 51 as my second course. And it was out of CS 50 and then 51 that, as you know, Shuttle Boy was born. So with that said, allow me to introduce Professor Greg Morissette and Raman Zabi, who teach Computer Science 51, our guests.
We're multiplexing mics. Hi, I'm Greg. I'm the Associate Dean for Computer Science and Engineering here at Harvard, which is just a fancy way of saying essentially the department chair. And next semester, I and my colleague, Raman Zabi, who's visiting us from Cornell University, will be teaching CS 51. And Raman and I and the course staff have been really rethinking 51, in large part because David Malin is so damn good at teaching 50 that we felt like we needed to revamp some things in 51. And so we've given it a lot of deep thought. And our hope here is to give you a flavor of some of the things that you'll see in 51. So Raman and I are going to tag team on this, because there are really a couple of different aspects about the course. The key thing is that we're going to try to transition folks from being people who can program. Lots of people can program. I have a 9-year-old son. He can program. Okay, and it's not just because I'm a geek. But lots of people can program. The difference is between programming and computer science, right? Making that transition so that you understand all of the aspects. So, and a lot of this boils down to looking at things from the right perspective. Whether it's a computational task or a task in some other domain, you'll find that computer science skills pay off. And from the right perspective, many, many problems that look very hard can become easy. And so in 51, one of the things that you're going to learn how to do is write not just code that gets the job done, but beautiful code. Poems, I like to say. Code that you want to take home and show to your mom. All right? It's code that you want to stroke and polish. Code that you love. All right? And you may think, well, that's just fun if you have lots of spare time, but it's actually very important because when you bake code down to that essence, when you pulled out just the right bits, when you have just the right flow, it's a work of art. And it's engineering-wise, very efficient. So one aspect of this is that you're going to learn how to write very elegant code, code that can be understood and easily modified. This is very important because, as you well know, especially from experience here, the structure of software and the requirements for a given project change all the time. And the whole reason it's soft, as opposed to hardware, is so that you can make those changes. But figuring out how to a priori structure code so that you can make the kinds of changes you'd like to make is a science, and something that you'll learn a lot about. The other thing that we're going to focus on is algorithmic aspects. There are new kinds of algorithms that have emerged in the last 10 to 15 years that computer science is engaging and using to transform all of science. All right, be it biology, be it statistics, be it psychology. And so we're going to introduce you to some of these ideas. And the key thing is that you're going to end up having a collection of ideas that allow you to solve big problems, big computational problems that at first glance don't look possible or even feasible. Okay. The other thing is you're going to sometimes be able to discover that certain problems that you think are really, really easy are in fact very, very hard. And you know, one of the tools in your tool bag will be after 51, the ability to recognize these problems easily and either transform the problem into something that is tractable or at least tell your boss or whoever's telling you you must solve this problem that it's a non-starter. Okay, so I just want to say a few things about programming and efficiency, programs and efficiency. So the right perspective on software can vastly simplify programming tasks. So my expertise is in programming languages and software engineering. So that's what I know a lot about. And the goal in the design of programming environments and programming languages is to have code that communicates not just with the machine but with other humans, because you're often working with somebody else, right? And so the code needs to be simple, readable, but also easily changed, easily modified to meet new requirements. Even today, another goal that we might have, especially for critical, tricky algorithms, is to actually formally prove the correctness of an algorithm. That doesn't happen often. But sometimes an algorithm is so important. For example, in Windows, you would love to have a proof that there could be no buffer overrun. Everybody knows what a buffer overrun is. I think David talked about it in class, right? So you'd love to have a formal proof that there's no buffer overrun in Windows. And of course, there isn't such a thing. But can we develop tools that would automatically be able to construct such a proof or transform code so that it has those properties? That's the kind of thing that when we talk about perspective, correctness we'd like to have. And the other thing is that the right perspective on software can vastly improve efficiency. And the goal is really to get fast code where the obvious way is too slow. A lot of times when you program stuff, you just throw it together and it works. But then you find out, ooh, if I give it a slightly bigger input, it starts to fall apart. All right? And so you want to be able to identify the critical parts of your code that can be restructured. And that gets back to if you have the right software programming environment, you can do that restructuring quickly. And sometimes change the problem. Okay. So the other thing that I want to point out is the language that we're going to use in 51 exclusively is a dialect of Scheme. All right, so it's a functional programming language. And why did we pick Scheme? We could have picked any of literally thousands of programming languages to teach there. That's what's not important. Over your lifetime as programmers and as software developers, you'll encounter hundreds of programming languages. Some of them you won't recognize as general purpose languages. They may be APIs. So for example, SQL is an API, but it's really a programming language. Regex, regular expressions, are another kind of programming language. CUDA. So Peter Pfister next year is going to teach a course on GPU programming. And that is a new emerging parallel programming design. You've heard about MapReduce in the context of Google. These are all programming languages that are really APIs to a big software service. So what's important is not learning a particular language, but learning the key concepts that make up all programming languages. And being able to recognize, oh, that's actually just a closure. Or, oh, that's actually something that I could encode with closures or with objects or this way or that if I need that kind of functionality when I go to solve a task. So what we're going to be concentrating on is not the particular programming language, but rather key linguistic concepts and key things and patterns that arise over and over again in software. And how do you recognize those and how do you recreate those in a new context? Okay, so the other thing that I want to say is that the right programming language does matter. Because oftentimes it can shape the way that you see the problem and formulate a solution. So my favorite example for this is try to write an arithmetic package that manipulates Roman numerals. Right? How would you write just an addition routine for Roman numerals? Right? You got to do 1 plus 1 is 2. But when you get up to 4, it's sort of weird representation. And when you get up to 5, it's even weirder. You got to remember all this mapping. It turns out Roman numerals are horrible as a representation for doing computation, arithmetic. Arabic numbers are much better. Binary is even better. It's even easier. All right. So if you are a Roman, though, and you're using Roman numerals, you would not even think about how to do something complicated with arithmetic because it would be hard. If you have the right programming language, then certain things look and are easy. And again, that gets back to having the right sort of concepts in your brain and being able to map them into the programming environment that you have at hand. So another example is that there are emerging things that happen all the time. So parallelism is a hot topic, right? And the programming languages of yesterday really aren't geared towards good kinds of parallelism. So a good example is you might have a game engine written in C++,
and you might really like it to perform very well, and so you'd like to use speculative concurrency as a way to speed up the computation. But it turns out that it's very hard to take standard imperative C++ code and make it speculatively concurrent. On the other hand, it's hard to take languages like Perl, which might be easier to do speculation for, and compile them efficiently. So why is that? Those are the sort of things that we're going to talk about in terms of software, programming languages, programming environments. So now I'm going to turn it over to Raman, and he's going to tell you about the other key perspective and focus in the course. Oh, I got one more thing. One more slide. I want to say also there's a deep connection, for those of you who are really into foundational mathematics, like me, between code and math. So it turns out that proofs and functional programming languages like Scheme have a deep correspondence. It even has a technical name called the Curry-Howard isomorphism. And so the key thing there is that analogs in proofs, like a proof by induction, corresponds to recursion in Scheme. And a proof by cases or pattern corresponds to pattern matching or a switch statement. And a proof by a lemma is really just a function application. And so one way that you can go about designing code to make sure it's right is to first write the proof. And if you write the proof, then you can just extract the code from the proof. And then you have simultaneously a proof of correctness of the code and the actual executable. Now, sometimes you can't do that in the context of an imperative programming language, but if you understand the models and the relationships between functional and imperative languages, then you can pull this kind of trick. And it works both ways. If you have a functional model of your imperative code, then you can start to construct proofs of properties about it. So these are the sort of things, the deep aspects of software that we're going to start to explore. But at the same time, we're going to talk about algorithmic issues.
I don't know if I'm, I guess I am live. Okay. So besides the sort of mind-bending ways of thinking about choosing your programming language, we're also going to look at trying to formulate your problem so it can run efficiently. And there's just a really amazing set of techniques we're going to show you at least some of in this course, including a number of things that are not traditionally done at the undergraduate level at all. Some of the material I'll show you is really typically covered in graduate courses, but we're sort of giving you sort of, you know, a carefully chosen, interesting version of it. So as Greg mentioned, there's usually an obvious way to solve some kind of computational problem. So for example, from CS50 in your spell checker dictionary, you could represent your dictionary just as an array, and you could just do a linear search of it. And there's almost always some kind of simple, straightforward solution. What happens if this thing is just way too slow? And when a computer scientist says way too slow, don't think, oh, it will take 10 minutes. Think more like it might take until the end of the universe. Okay, in that case, sometimes it turns out that there are vastly better solutions. And I'll show you a little toy example in just a moment where with a little bit of cleverness you can actually do much, much better. Moreover, sometimes it turns out that problems that look hard turn out to be easy. Sometimes problems that are easy turn out that look easy turn out to actually be hard. And we're going to teach you sort of ways of thinking about these problems that can allow you to distinguish these cases. And as you'll see in just a moment, it's actually quite tricky. Some of these things that look very similar to each other have very different properties. And sometimes you can just end up, you know, discovering that the task that someone suggested that you try to figure out is just too hard. You can prove that you can't, and maybe suggest some way of modifying the problem instead. So we're going to cover all of these possibilities. And now for the remaining couple of 10 or 15 minutes, I'm going to preview for you a few sample problems. And these are sample problems that are intended to illustrate the kind of techniques we're going to cover. And they're not exactly traditional computer science problems, perhaps. Okay, so here are some friends on Facebook. Probably the only face you might not recognize is the guy at the bottom left. That's Larry Summers. All right, so here's a question. Let's suppose that Barack gets some good news, and we'll tell you a particular piece of good news he got recently, maybe not the obvious one. And we're going to look at how he can spread that news to his friends. And in particular, we'll look at an initial version of this problem that I'm calling the conversation problem. So every person in the conversation problem should have a conversation with each friend. You want to sort of find a way for the good news to spread. So here's a little example. So here's our people, and Brock discovers a piece of good news, and he tells his Secretary of State, and she tells him, "All right." And then she tells her husband, and he responds in kind. The news continues to propagate. Eventually, everyone has heard the good news. Okay, so that's our sort of our first version of the problem. So we want everyone to sort of have this conversation, and we want them all to have a conversation once. I'm certain that for some of them, once is more than enough. Okay, so that seems like a reasonable problem. Let's look at a slightly different variant of the problem, where again, Barack is going to share his good news. And in this version of the problem, each person hears the news once through a friend. And again, you want to figure out a way for the news to spread. So here's the notification problem. So Barack has the same piece of good news. He's happy. He tells the Secretary of State. She's not so happy. She tells her husband. He's not happy. Ted's happy. Okay, the news keeps on spreading. And eventually, we're going to spread it through this entire little mini Facebook example, so that every person learns it once. Okay, so we have these two problems, and they look really, really similar. We're sort of trying to spread the news through the network on Facebook so that everyone learns at once. Okay, there's actually a really easy way to solve both these problems. You'll notice that I said easy, not smart. In particular, you can just try exhaustive search. If you want to figure out how Barack can sort of pass the news through the network, you can just consider all the different ways. You know, he can first send it to one of a couple different people, they can send it to one of their neighbors, et cetera, et cetera. You just try every possibility. The problem is that in my little, you know, seven-person example, that would not take too long, but in a really big network, it would take a really long time. We'll talk about that in a moment. And it can especially take a long time if there are lots of people with lots of friends, because after all, Barack has like a million friends. If you're trying to think about all the people he could send it next to, there are a million of those. Each of those might have another 1,000 friends. Now you're up to a billion possibilities just immediately. Okay. So it can take a really long time. There's also kind of another thing that you can imagine, another sort of obvious solution to this problem, which is that you simply, you know, send it to someone who hasn't heard the news, right? That's another kind of obvious algorithm, and we'll call that the greeting method. You just pick a neighbor, and you notify them about the news, or you have a conversation with them. You just pick a neighbor that doesn't know about the news or that you haven't had a conversation with. And you could make this a little bit cleverer, perhaps, by being smarter about your choice of neighbors. So, for example, you might imagine sending it first to, if you have a lot of neighbors who haven't heard the news, you first send it to the one of your neighbors who's the most popular, because you'll figure that they'll send it to a lot of people that afterwards. Okay. Sometimes it turns out that for some networks, the news just can't be spread at all. So how could this happen? Well, in this particular network, it actually works out pretty well. But there's an easy little example. Suppose that there's someone out there, or maybe two people out there, who just have no friends. It's kind of sad. How could you imagine a pair of people whose only friends are each other? Okay. In this particular case, you just can't spread the news. Sorry. That's not probably their most pressing problem at the moment. All right. These problems actually look extremely similar. We're spreading the news on Facebook, we're spreading it between friends, and we're trying to avoid repetition. One of these problems is really easy, and one of them isn't. Okay. Turns out that one of these problems can be solved pretty easily in order n time. The word pretty easily there is maybe a little bit deceptive. If you think about it carefully, you can solve it pretty easily. The solution is to use the greedy method, just kind of send it to someone who hasn't, you know, send it to the right neighbor with a little bit of cleverness. For the other problem, no one can do much better than exhaustive search. You know, I told you that it would take a really long time, and no one actually knows how to do much better than that. So let's take a quick poll. So remember, we have these two problems. There's the conversation problem and the notification problem. The conversation problem, pairs of people have conversations. The notification problem, everybody hears it once. One of them is easy. One of them is hard. How many of you think that the first problem, the problem where they're having conversations, is hard? Raise your hand. No one thinks it's hard. Few people think it's hard. Okay. How about the other one, where you have to send it to your friends? Okay. Most people think, okay, so that's what more people think. That turns out to be correct, by the way. But it's not at all obvious. It takes a bit of thought. And in fact, Greg and I were talking about having the same question at a faculty meeting. It's not so clear. The problems really look pretty close to each other. However, for the notification problem and for problems like that, no one knows how to do much better than exhaustive search. And if you can do better, you'll be the most famous computer scientist in the world and win a number of fabulous prizes, including a PhD from the university of your choice and $1 million. There's actually a it's one of the open problems for the Clay Institute. Okay, so that's our first little example of the kind of problem we'll look at. All right. Here's another example of a fun problem. So this man, probably none of you have actually met him, and probably a few of you have even heard of him, but perhaps he has the world's toughest job. This is Jay Allard. He's a corporate vice president at Microsoft. His job is to make the Zune popular. He must be an incredible optimist. Okay, some of you are probably at this point wondering what a Zune might be. It's kind of like an iPod. But it has two important features. Feature number one, it can't use iTunes. Is that a feature? Feature number two is it's made by Microsoft. Okay. So, let's try to help Jay out, because God knows he needs help. How could he make Zunes popular? Well, okay, so giving up is, for the moment, we'll just assume that that's not an option. Microsoft doesn't have that much money, but they can scrape together some money for a couple of free Zunes, say 25 of them. And his idea is that he wants to give them to Facebook users. Jay has got to be an incredible optimist, or he would have quit long ago. So his idea is he's going to give them out to some Facebook users, and these people will like them. As I said, he's kind of an optimistic guy, and they'll tell their friends. Now, when we sort of think about this problem, we're going to make a little simplifying assumption, which is that, you know, he's going to give some free Zunes to people, and those people will tell their friends. And if someone has a free Zune and shows it to you, maybe you get interested, but you'll get more excited if someone else shows you their free Zune. Basically, having another friend with a free Zune doesn't make you any more interested. This is actually somewhat like immunization. If you think of Zunes as being kind of like a disease, once you've sort of been exposed, you're immunized. And while I am, of course, taking the opportunity to make fun of Microsoft, the link to immunization is actually quite deep. There's a wide area of hot research that studies the way that things like diseases and ideas and fashion spread among people through networks. It's an area called social networks. This example kind of comes from that. Okay, so let's look at our problem in a little bit more detail. Here are two options for our friend Jay. Maybe he's taken CS51 or some variant of it. So here are two ideas. So the first idea is exhaustive search. Let's try every group of 25 people on Facebook and figure out what the best one would be. That's guaranteed to find the best group of people. By which I mean it will reach the most people. So what you want to do is you want to pick 25 people where that group of 25 people collectively has the most friends, because they'll hopefully tell their friends about it. Okay, there's one small problem with this algorithm, which is that if you run it, you have to really hope the universe doesn't end first, and the odds are not good. Here's another option for Jay, the greedy algorithm. So what's the greedy algorithm here? Well, let's give the first to Barack. He has the most friends. He's a popular guy these days. Let's give the second most to Hillary. She has the second most friends. And that seems kind of like a natural thing to do. So does this work, and can you do better? Well, let's try running our little greedy algorithm on our network. So we give it to Barack, and again, this is like Jay's dream sequence, right? He gives it to Barack. Barack likes it, first of all, low chance, and tells his friends about it, lower chance, and they therefore like it. So now Barack's told all his friends about it, and all these people know about it. So now we tell Hillary, and she tells her friends. Little problem here. Her friends have already heard about it. So the problem with this greedy solution is that Barack's and Hillary's friends overlap a lot, at least in our example, maybe not so much in real life. In this little example, she actually adds nothing. Frighteningly enough, if you go back to the little example and you want to give it to two people, the first one is Barack. Who's the second one? George or Dick. That's right. Kind of frightening property. That's right, because Barack's already covered all these guys. Okay, so you want popular people, but you also want ones with distinct friends, which makes the problem a little more tricky. So let's go back to thinking about the exhaustive solution. And let's just think just kind of on the back of the envelope about how long it would take it to run. So let's suppose that Facebook only had 10 million users. It has way more than 10 million users. How many groups of 25 would there be? The answer is over 10 to the 149th. Okay, which is one of those numbers that, you know, in just five characters is more or less an inconceivable number. Just to give you some, you know, some sort of back of the envelope calculations, the age of the universe is less than 10 to the 18th seconds, even if you're not a creationist. So if you could try 10 to the 100th groups, if in a single second you could try you could consider 10 to the 100th possibilities, okay? 10 to the 100th is, of course, a Google. Okay? If you could try that ridiculous number of possibilities in a single second, and you started running this algorithm when the universe began, you wouldn't be done yet, okay? And it's unlikely you would finish. Just to give you yet another sort of, way of thinking about this problem, they're about 10 to the 80th elementary particles. No one's really counted, but it's, you know, 10 to the 80th plus or minus, you know, a few. So you really can't solve this problem by exhaustive search, as it turns out. So exhaustive search, not so good. Greedy algorithm didn't work so well. What can you do? Can we actually beat exhaustive search? Can we figure out a way to distribute these damn zones in a way that actually, you know, really, you know, gets the right set? And is that doable? Well, if you can figure it out, you will win some fabulous prizes, $1 million and a PhD. So let's look at a solution to this problem. A sort of slightly clever algorithm. And in fact, there's a question mark on this slide because the algorithm isn't necessarily all that clever, but it has a very non-obvious property. So here's our clever algorithm. You begin by giving the zoom to Barack. I mean, that's kind of the obvious thing to do. You give it to the most popular person. Now what you do is you forget about him and all his friends because they've already been infected. Sorry, they've already learned about the zoom. Okay, you don't need to consider them anymore. And now you give it to whoever's left who has the most friends. And then you forget about them. And you continue doing this until you've distributed the entire set of 25, until Microsoft's budget for giving out free zooms has been exhausted. You run that method. Now, on the surface, this is actually about as straightforward an algorithm as you can possibly imagine, right? You can write that in a couple lines of code. It turns out it has an amazing property. Remember, you can't actually find the best solution without sort of trying everything. Well, let's pretend that if you were willing to try all 10 to the 149th solutions, you would be able to sort of slowly find a way to reach a million people. It turns out that this simple algorithm will actually quickly reach over 632,120 people. You have to be a pretty serious geek to know what 632,120 is. We'll leave it as a little exercise. It's kind of amazing. So this really simple algorithm will actually get you very close to the right answer. Okay. Two more quick problems, then I'll turn it over to to Matt. Here's a problem that was on the New York Times recently. Let's suppose that someone goes through a shopping cart and buys a couple of things from Walmart. They buy these items, a pogo stick, beer and diapers, beer and diapers in a bad movie, beer and God knows what, and three God knows whats. What can you conclude? Well, probably this Walmart is near a college campus. Beer and diapers are also fairly popular, but not quite as popular. You might be interested in trying to analyze this data. This is actually a really important problem. Try to figure out what's popular, because if things are popular, you might put them next to each other. Here's another related problem that we'll also look at. So here's a nice view of a college campus. That's Maxwell Dworkin kind of at the bottom right. Let's suppose that you're out in this quad and you meet a student speaking legal gibberish. So we mark them there. And then you meet another one, and pretty soon there's a whole flood of them. And your question is, where are they all coming from? Which building is the source? Another question you might sort of think about, there are kind of obvious ways to answer it, and maybe less obvious ways. A closely related problem is just this general notion of trying to sort of partition your data, make sense of your data in some sort of reasonable way. So here's an example. You might have a collection of music where you have sort of classical music, which is, you know, slow and soft, and some other music as well. Maybe these things at the bottom left are in your sort of, you know, nighttime collection. The things at the top right are things you play to get up in the morning. Here's a new album. Which one is it most like? And problems like this have many formulations, sort of trying to explore the formulations for the data. And these many formulations, turns out that with the right perspective, there are ways you can solve this problem fast. Okay. And those kinds of right perspectives, both on programming tasks and on algorithmic tasks, are the kind of thing that Greg and I will cover in CS51. So we hope to see you next semester.